Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is the Healthy Mind Radio Show. Here, we talk about our emotional health and well-being, about living the most authentic life we possibly can, the one we truly deserve. So take notice, our true strength and action are on the march, while our fears and self-doubt are on the run. Never doubt how truly powerful you are. Let's learn together, right here on The Healthy Mind. Oh yes, together we are going to do it. Welcome everybody, welcome. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is The Healthy Mind Podcast for July 4th, 2012. A very, very happy 4th of July to you. I hope that your holiday is going well or went well if you're listening to it after the 4th. Thank you so much for joining us here on The Healthy Mind. I have an absolute jam-packed program for you today, and it is going to be a really good one. I've got some great, great news on the mind-body interface, particularly as it relates to my area of interest, but some beautiful new research, groundbreaking research that's been done on the interface of emotions and physical pain. How our emotions impact the physical pain that we feel. And it really is real. And I'll show it to you here with these amazing studies that just came out. I also have some great health news for you this week as well. The healing power of daydreaming. Oh, yes, of daydreaming. You're going to want to stick around for that, especially parents, as it relates to really strengthening that attention, the potential to focus for our children. We'll do some headlines, and hey, we have ourselves a huge program. So I am really, really happy that you are here. Well, you know, I was trying to come up with a topic for the show, and wouldn't you know it, the topic just kind of made itself. I was looking through the news like I always do to see what's going on in the world of psychology and psychiatry, emotional health. And this new study that came out of Northwestern University, the headline here, chronic pain is all in your head. It's all in your head. A startling new study. Now, my area of interest in psychiatry is in the way that we physically express our emotions, the way that we will take anxiety or anger or rage or futility and then manifest that as a physical symptom, particularly pain. And I've talked before on the podcast about my influence from, to me, one of the greatest minds in medicine, Dr. John Sarno, as he talked about TMS, tension myositis syndrome, where a group of us is taking it further, psychophysiologic disorders, but how the emotions play in to physical pain. If you've been listening to the podcast regularly, I've talked many, many times about the role that emotions, depression, anxiety plays in the outcomes of some of the major health disorders that our country faces. Hypertension, diabetes, inflammatory disorders. Having depression or anxiety at the same time greatly increases the disease burden of those other disorders. It makes hypertension worse. It makes diabetes worse. So there really is an urgency to aggressively treat depression and anxiety and other emotional disorders, not just so that you're feeling better, but that in doing that, it can potentially lessen the intensity of your physical, non-psychiatric, non-emotional disorders, like hypertension or diabetes. But this study was fascinating, because the big issue in medicine, particularly as it relates to pain and chronic pain, if two people have, say, similar injuries, you injure your knee or your back, why is it that some people will go on to have chronic pain while others will recover and never have pain again? Why does this happen? This is the big conundrum. Does it depend on one's personality? How much of it does our biology have to do with it? Well, according to this new, first-of-its-kind, really, brain imaging study, the researchers at Northwestern University were able to predict with significant accuracy, up to 85% accuracy, based on changes that they saw on the MRIs early on in the brain, which of these patients would go on to develop chronic pain. So how is this possible? What's going on here? Well, what this research study was able to show was that chronic pain develops the more two sections of the brain related. Now, here's the important part to emotional and motivational behavior. Those two areas of the brain talk to each other. The more these two areas of the brain communicate, the greater the chance that a patient will develop chronic pain. But the important part here to realize so far, I hope you're beginning to see, is that the emotional centers of the brain are what are suggesting who will go on to have chronic pain or not. The emotions, not the findings of where the injury is. And as I said, this was an amazing study. The researchers were able to predict, get this, with 85% accuracy at the beginning of the study. Now, that's important. What they did was take a group of patients who didn't have chronic pain, but had just had an acute pain episode. So these aren't people who have recovered from chronic pain. These people had pain for the first time. And based on the level of interaction between those areas of the brain, an area of the brain known as both the frontal cortex and another area known as the nucleus accumbens, they were able to predict with significant precision which of these patients would go on to have chronic pain. Now, according to Dr. Vanya Aparkarian, he's the senior author of the paper, and he's a professor of physiology at Northwestern University's School of Medicine. He stated, quote, "For the first time, we can explain why people who may have the exact same initial pain either go on to recover or go on to develop chronic pain." Now, the important part that the researchers pointed out was that the injury was not enough to explain why pain continues, why it turns into chronic pain. Because why? Well, injuries heal. They don't continue. So it wasn't that. And what they felt was it had to do with the injury combined with the state of the brain. And according to the researchers, this was the culmination of 10 years of research to be able to come to these conclusions. Now, if you look at the study, what they had found was that the more emotional a person was, or how the brain reacts to the initial injury, the more likely the pain will persist after the injury has healed. Now, let me say that again. The more emotional outlay at that injury time, the greater the chance the pain will continue even after the injury has healed. Now, back to Dr. Aparkarian, quote, "It may be that these sections of the brain are more excited to begin with in certain individuals, or that there may be genetic and environmental influences that predispose these brain regions to interact at an excitable level." And how that exactly happens, we don't know. But the point still remains, and the main take-home message that I want you to take from this is that the emotions, not even the injury itself, but the emotions are the basis for the physical pain, not so much the injury, if there is even an injury at all. When people come in and talk to me, when they come in and they say, gosh, I've gone through MRI and nerve conduction study and nerve block and all of this, but they can't find the reason why I'm in pain. Well, it's very important to understand when we say the emotions may be the reason you are hurting, that it's not something that is being made up. The pain is very real. It's as real as if you hit my hand with a hammer. It is real. But where it starts may not have anything to do with the site of the injury or where a person is feeling the pain. It's very hard for people to try and accept the fact that emotions or a psychological process could be contributing or starting their pain without them thinking, I'm not strong enough. You're not telling me that I'm a weak person. Are you telling me I'm making this up? These are very common responses, but that isn't it. There's a purpose there for the pain. And it's studies like this that continue, at least within the scientific community, and also as it filters down to patients, to understand the complex interaction between emotions and physical pain, psychology and physical symptoms. Now, another study that I wanted to touch upon here that kind of dovetails onto this earlier one was a study that was done by researchers in Israel. And what they had found was that viewing terrorist attacks on TV increases pain intensity. Viewing terrorism on TV, an anxiety-provoking event full of emotions, increases physical symptoms. The emotions will play themselves out with physical symptoms. So when we talk about that, or you do your research into the physical manifestations of emotional symptoms, keep in mind the pain is very real. No one is doubting you on that. And if physicians or other medical professionals are doubting you, get a new one. Get one that understands this, okay? Because we are starting to put this together in a way that is very clear. Many, many people have known this for a long period of time, but as anything, we need the science to validate the emotional overlay of physical symptoms. So the future is bright. The future is so bright because when we look at the physical manifestations of emotional symptoms, there's purpose there. But irrespective of the purpose, it is showing a strong individual who is trying to survive despite the pain, whether it is physical or emotional. People continue to carve out lives and move forward every single day in their life despite the suffering that they have. Now that, my friends, is strength. And there are ways to move past that physical pain and hopefully get it gone once and for all. You can do it. Don't doubt your strength. That, my friends, is such an important step to take as we walk down our road to the healthy mind. And now, it's time for news. Okay, well, another busy, busy week in health news, and I'm going to stay kind of along this theme of the mind-body, the way that emotions will impact physical illness as well. Because I want people to understand that when I talk about the emotions and making sure that you're at your top emotional and psychological well-being, it isn't just for the sake of feeling better emotionally. Because from all of the science, the emotions are having a meaningful and significant impact on the body's ability to heal physically. Okay? So I wanted to stick with that particular theme here. The headline, Childhood Adversity Increases the Risk for Depression and Chronic Inflammation. So what happens when we injure ourselves? You hurt your knee, what happens? It becomes inflamed. Or if you've got a bad cold or a sore throat, what happens? Our throat gets inflamed. We all know inflammation in and of itself is not really a problem in a healthy reaction of the body to either some type of injury or infection. But too much inflammation is thought to be the cause for many of the biggest health problems that we have. Cardiovascular disease, diabetes, cancers, and a growing body of evidence that perhaps inflammation is a critical part for some individuals of depression forming in the first place. But what this particular study was able to find was that when a person experiences a psychological trauma, not only do they feel more depressed and anxious, but inflammation increases significantly. And this inflammation can be quite destructive. Now, what this particular group of researchers did was they recruited a large group of female adolescent participants. Now, they were healthy, but they were at a high risk for experiencing depression. And they followed these volunteers for about 2.5 years. They would do interviews about what was going on in their lives. They would note when they're depressed, and they would also give blood samples as well. Now, why would they give blood samples? The researchers measured certain inflammatory markers. And I've talked about these very ones on previous podcasts and also in some of the articles that I've posted up on thehealthymind.com. They looked at specifically interleukin-6, IL-6, and another protein known as C-reactive protein. Both of these proteins are kind of inflammatory markers. Whenever we have inflammation going on in our body, we can measure that, and we know that these proteins will increase in the bloodstream. And they also looked at their exposure to childhood adversity. So adolescents, interviewing them, checking blood, watching if they're getting depressed, and also did they have adversity earlier on in their life as children? And what did they find? Well, researchers found that when individuals suffered from early childhood trauma, when they became depressed, their depression was accompanied by an inflammation response. The increase in those inflammatory markers, C-reactive protein, interleukin-6, went up in those individuals. But there's more there. In addition to that, particularly with those individuals that had trauma in their childhood, the high levels of these inflammatory markers put them at greater risk for another episode of depression up to 6 months later. So, okay, we've got that. What about those that didn't have any childhood adversity? How about those adolescents? And this is where the stunning part comes. In those volunteers without childhood adversity, there was absolutely no coupling between depression and inflammation. Think about the implications there. Something that happened many years in the past will have an impact with depression that you may have today and the physiologic response of inflammation. Wow. I mean, this is what we've been talking about in mind-body medicine for years and years. But now science is beginning to understand what some of the individual nuances, details of all of this exactly is. According to one of the lead researchers, Dr. Gregory Miller, quote, "What's important about this study is that it identifies a group of people who were prone to have depression and inflammation at the same time. That group of people experienced major stress in childhood. That group experienced a major stress in childhood, having a parent with severe illness or a lasting separation from the family. As a result, these individuals may experience depressions that are especially difficult to treat." End of quotes. Now, it got my mind kind of buzzing around. One of the biggest problems that we have in psychiatry is treatment-resistant depression. How much of treatment-resistant depression is really about not finding the right medication when it may have been a trauma that had occurred in the distant, distant past in a person's life? Wow, the implications are incredible. But what I hope that you can take away from this particular study is that the emotional reaction, much like what I talked about earlier with pain, but the emotional reaction, a trauma, be it early or at any time, but especially in this study being early, has huge implications on an individual and their depression, but also in their physiologic reaction, in this case, inflammation. And that inflammation, it could add to a person's hypertension or cardiovascular disease or diabetes. This is why there is an urgency to make sure that we are as aggressively as possible treating for these emotional disorders. Childhood trauma increasing the risk for not only depression, but chronic inflammation. Okay, now, the next piece of news, and I thought this was an important one. I have it up on thehealthymind.com as well. Parents, I would really encourage you to go ahead and take a look at this particular study and the research. But the headline, "The Healing Power of Daydreaming and Mindful Reflection." Now, for all of us, I mean, the pace of today's world can be mind-numbing, and it seems like every single day we're going faster and faster and faster. I know I feel it. And there never seems to be just any time to just take a break, just for a few moments even, to just be. How many times on this podcast have I said, make sure you take that time just to be? But it's hard. I get it. Work and family and social obligations and everything, it takes our time. But while those moments of time to just be and maybe reflect may be hard to come by, a new study from USC, the University of Southern California, suggests that those moments of reflection or introspection, even daydreaming, may be an increasingly valuable part of our life. And we might want to reconsider how luxurious we think being able to daydream or just to kind of reflect is. Now, in recent years, researchers have looked at the idea of rest, or brain rest, if you will, looking at what's called the default mode network of the brain. And I'll be talking about this more. I'm trying to get one of probably the country's leading experts in the default mode network of the brain. But this talks about a network that's really active when we're resting or we're focusing inwards, just kind of thinking. And they talked about the importance of mindful reflection and inward attention. Now, mindful reflection is so critical because that's how we make meaning about the world around us. And inward attention is really important for all of us. It's so important in our development. Moral thinking, reasoning, all of that comes from the time that we take to think, go inward, and consider everything that is happening to us and what we would like to do or achieve or become. Now, the particular focus or purpose of the study was to look at what implication does this have either on adolescents and children, particularly because there are so many things competing for attention that it's hard for children and adolescents these days to really even know how to unplug, if you will, and just be. And as the research suggests, there's cost to that if we don't take the time to rest, to brain rest, if you will, through either reflection or daydreaming. According to one of the researchers, Dr. Imordino Yang, she's a professor at University of Southern California, quote, "We focus on the outside world in education and don't look much at inwardly focused reflective skills and attentions. But inward focus impacts the ways that we build memories, make meaning, and transfer learning into new contexts," end of quotes. And she went on to say, what are we really doing with our kids in schools to support the kids' ability to be able to turn inward, to empower them with that ability, to let them know that that is important to do? And as the research is turning out, children could be suffering more than we realize without that ability to do so, because these networks that they are learning about underlie a focus inwards versus outwards. And that's important because the two are interdependent. How we relate outward to the world, what we want to accomplish, depends on many things. But of critical importance is also the time that we take for ourselves, the time that is ours, time that we will spend reflecting or thinking or meditating. It's so important because it achieves a couple of purposes. Number one, it reminds us very subtly and even unconsciously that we have the right and the freedom and the strength to be able to take that time for ourselves. We own that control. But also, we give ourselves that time, the mindfulness of the moment, where we are at our most healthy. That is what lets us grow and become stronger people for ourselves, for our families, for our communities. In this particular study, the researchers, like Dr. Yang, worry that the high attention demands of fast-paced digital environments may be undermining opportunities for young people to look inwards. You've got social media, everything is competing for your attention. Kids are multitasking, watching TV, texting on the phone, surfing the internet. It's happening. But how much time are people taking to really reflect inwards and take that time? Perhaps the most important conclusion to take from this particular research on the brain and the resting condition of the brain, kind of this default mode network, is that all rest, and this is important, all rest is not idleness. Now, while we may think that taking time for ourselves and resting is a wasted opportunity for being productive, what the researchers are showing is that constructive internal reflection and thought is critical for learning from past experiences and appreciating their value for future choices. And this helps us to better manage and navigate ourselves through the world. So I really encourage you, if you're a parent, take the time to look at this and research it. We are so productivity focused and have to just go, go, go. But sometimes taking that time to just be allows us to accomplish so much more. Take that time, the healing power of daydreaming and mindful reflection. Now, with the time that we have left, I just want to blast through the remainder of the news headlines in a segment that I like to call the Healthy Mind Headlines. Okay, the first headline. Chronic inflammation in the brain leads the way to Alzheimer's disease. Continuing on this theme today, I'm telling you. Research published in the Journal of Neuroinflammation suggests that chronic inflammation can predispose the brain to develop Alzheimer's. Think about that and what we just talked about with mood and inflammation. The next headline. Self-distancing can help people calm aggressive reactions. A new study reveals a simple strategy that people can use to minimize how angry and aggressive they got when they were provoked by others. And this was an Ohio State University study picturing yourself watching yourself react actually allowed people to have less anger. Self-distancing. And finally, the headline, The Advantages of Being First. How people make choices depends on many factors, but a new study finds that people consistently prefer the options that came first. First in line, first college to offer you an acceptance, the first item on a menu, no matter what. First was considered to be the most appealing. First, it turns out, really is best. How about that? Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have done it again, you and I. We have made it to the end of yet another broadcast of The Healthy Mind. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. I really do appreciate it. The website, as always, www.thehealthymind.com. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter, at Dr. Zafiridis. Any questions you may have, don't hesitate to contact me. I want to hear from you. The email address, peter@thehealthymind.com. That's peter@thehealthymind.com. And for the Healthy Mind Podcast, part of the Healthy Mind Network, I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis. Have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next time right here on the Healthy Mind Podcast.